Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And true to form, there's always something new happening in the South and in the world of this Southern cooking. We're going to start out today with somebody.
We have three different flavors of that for you today.
We do.
And here we go.
And Vivian Howard, she has just been on, right in the front of all the awards programs and news for a long time this part of the year. And she's just, she's dealing with a different sort of Southern cooking, one that you maybe never really identified before. And listen up, and she'll tell you about her wonderful book and her restaurant, Deep Run Roots. We're excited to be talking to Vivian Howard, chef, television star, and, you know, a fabulous writer. Vivian, you write so well, and it's so wonderful reading the book, the words, the humor that's built into it all. The book is called Deep Run Roots, Stories and Recipes from My Corner of the South. So I thought we should begin by having you explain what constitutes your corner of the South.
Well, I live in eastern North Carolina, so really North Carolina is divided into three distinct portions. There's the coastal plain, or eastern North Carolina, where I live, Piedmont, which is in the center of the state, and there's rolling hills there, and then the Appalachian Mountains. So the coastal plain is defined by agriculture, very flat land, once totally reliant on tobacco.
Yes, so it ended up being poor, right?
Yes, we are experiencing a dramatic economic disaster, but probably best for the future of the planet.
But you know what? I mean, your publicist at Little Brown said that you don't like doing things the easy way. So you picked up and opened this restaurant in the midst of the 80s. Misery, economic misery. Your husband, I imagine he wasn't really thrilled to be moving to this little town, right?
Well, actually, he grew up in Chicago, and we met in New York, and he was enchanted by kind of the rural bucolic qualities of eastern North Carolina. So he was more into the idea of moving here than I was.
Oh, okay. Well, that takes us, we should jump back. Describe exactly, you were dying to get out of this little town called Deep Run, right?
Yes, it's really more like a fire district.
Yeah, you said it wasn't a town, it was a fire district with more pigs than people.
Yes.
So then, where did you go?
I left home at 14 and went to boarding school and did everything in my power from that point on to come back as little as possible. Holidays were about it. Uh-huh. And I moved to New York when I was 22, and I worked in advertising there, and then quit that job, became a server in a restaurant in the West Village, and eventually started cooking.
And that got in your blood, right?
Yes. I started cooking really because I wanted to be a food writer, but after spending time in professional kitchens, I learned that I was, at least at that point, better at cooking than I was writing, and I loved the camaraderie of the kitchen, and I loved the feeling of working toward a common goal, the teamwork that professional kitchens are all about. So, yeah, I became obsessed with it, actually.
Now, it turns out that the writing sort of came along pretty well, too, because and gave you a compliment before you came on the air. She said, you wrote absolutely brilliantly. I'm sure that, so somehow or other you caught that one.
Yeah, you know, I think that, I had always written little stories and journal entries, and it's something that I love to do, and, I love to make people laugh. So I think that's one of the things that I'm able to do in my storytelling that is not something you suspect in a cookbook. And, yeah, I'm really proud of it.
Well, you know, you say that this book is very personal to you. And it's as much your storytelling as it is your recipe writing, right?
Yes, I'd say it's about half and half.
Right. And I found it interesting how you organize the book around these ingredients.
Yes, the book is organized by ingredients. The ingredients that I feel define the plates of Eastern North Carolina, and the ingredients themselves, the order of the book, is not alphabetical or seasonal. It's really more the order of the journey of my life. So every chapter opens with a story about that ingredient and how it helps shape me and make me who I am.
Well, I mean, the recipes are memorable, I must say. I mean, I grew up, my grandmother made watermelon rind pickles, but I never had the bacon wrapped. That's really great.
Well, you're missing out. That's, that's one of the most satisfying little hors d'oeuvres, I think, that you could possibly have. It's salty and sweet and crunchy and easy once you've made the pickles.
Right, when you do make the pickles. You have, like, your rules, Vivian's rules, and I found some of them really hysterically funny.
can you give us some examples?
Yeah. How about some examples of your rules?
Well, I mean, I'm not one of these very gadget-oriented chefs. I don't have a whole lot of different knives or things like that, but the things that I love, I really love, like my microplane. I think I said in the book that I slept with my microplane.
I agree with you, by the way.
And it's changed. I don't know what we did before they came around. I'm a big advocate for Y-shaped vegetable peelers.
Yes.
I think that they should just do away with all the other ones.
Right.
I hate peeling garlic. So in most of my recipes, garlic meets heat. I spent a fair amount of time in the basement of WD-50 peeling garlic while service went on above me, and so I have a deep distaste for the task.
Yeah, that one surprised me that you like this.
I wanted to share this with you because I picked up something out of Charlie Palmer's cookbook that you could actually prepare the garlic for cooking by just smashing the cloves using the handle of your knife.
Well, that's how I do
and it.
And
it sure is a whole lot quicker than peeling it.
Yeah, but you know, that takes more time than you think. I have tried every which way, and it's never as quick as just opening up the container of peeled garlic.
There you go. Now, I did want to ask you a question. This is not in an appropriate place in this interview, but I want to get it in there. So, are you familiar with the work of a writer called T.R. Pearson? He was a university professor somewhere in North Carolina. He wrote this amazingly humorous book called A Short History of a Small Place. And it seems to me like Deep Run might be that small place.
Yeah.
So I'll have to look that up.
You'll get a kick out of it.
T as in Tom, R as in Robert, Pearson, P-E-A-R-S-O-N. He wrote another one called Headed for the Great Hereafter.
Yeah.
To give you an idea, one of the main themes of one of the books was that somebody had a pet monkey, and the pet monkey climbed up a utility pole, and the local people used to opened a book on when he went to the toilet, how far away from the foot of the flagpole it would land. Because they got nothing else to do there.
Right, exactly. That's the short history of a small place.
You got to look it up. It'll stimulate you. I'm sure there's a flavor of that kind of writing in Deep Roots.
Oh, good.
Well, you know, I have two questions. I don't know what order to put them in here. One, I want to know what you rediscovered that you had overlooked that caused you to go back to Deep Run. And the other one is the big issue of how one of your missions is to separate out your region from the mass of Southern cooking that's been treated like all one big chunk of the same shrimp and grits and fried chicken.
Right. Right. Well, I think I can kind of answer both of those with one story, I guess. So when I was in New York and I started, the restaurant that I worked in, the name of it was Voyage, and the concept was Southern food via Africa. And, you know, I'm this 23-year-old country girl who knew that I grew up in the South. But I didn't realize that we had a distinct cuisine. I just thought our food was really boring. And the chef told all these stories about the reason that these dishes were what they were. But none of them were the dishes that I grew up eating. So he was describing a Southern food that I had really no connection to. So it piqued my curiosity about the South that I grew up in. And so when I moved back here, I started paying attention to our food and what it was that was distinct about it. Eat shrimp and grits, and we didn't eat gumbo, and we had, you know, this weird barbecue chicken that was doused in vinegar.
I love that.
And so I realized that although I was smack dab in the middle of the South, that my people's food was different than many parts of the South. And much of the Southern food we learn about or that people associate with the South is Southern food from the port cities. So, you know, Charleston, Savannah,
right.
New Orleans. But much of the South and much of the cooking that comes from farming and frugality is from the rural agricultural South. And that's really more representative of the food of Eastern North Carolina.
I think I should point out that this book is going to be very hard to condense into a single interview. By the way, congratulations that you won three, I believe, IACP, International Association of Culinary Professionals Awards. Four. See, I thought I missed one out because I got a separate memo about the other one. Tell us what awards were.
Well, I won Deep Run Roots won the general cookbook category, and the chef and restaurants cookbook category, and I won the Julia Child first cookbook award, and then Deep Run Roots won cookbook of the year. So it was like
everything. Go ahead.
And really humbling, and it just happened last week, and I still kind of feel like someone's going to come and take
them
away. Away.
Well, I tell you what, they better come with a hand truck, because this is one big book.
It's a big book.
You don't kind of throw this book around. I think
it's five pounds.
One of the words in the review from the publishing house said it was svelte. I think that might be the opposite would be the right answer.
Yeah, I think they must have been trying to be facetious, maybe.
I think that's what it was.
I think so.
I think that's it.
You have a lot of good words to say about collards, which, by the way, we love too.
Yeah, you know, collards are, you know, I say at some point in the book, if you grow up in the South, you're either a collard eater or a turnip eater. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in a turnip eating house and came to collards later in life. But now I think they're an incredibly versatile grain. You know, I think that typically we think of them as being very slow stewed and cooked to death, almost to mush. But one of the most popular things in our restaurant is a flash fried collard, and it's like it becomes a chip. And I also use collard leaves like you would grape leaves and wrap them around a filling and steam them. So because they are so sturdy and durable, they're very versatile.
Yeah, well, we love them too. We've had them in Charleston with a red wine sauce. It's really great too.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
That was Bob Wagoner.
Bob Wagoner.
That
could have been the best collards I've ever had.
Yeah, they were pretty good.
That sounds great.
Yeah. So you're very opinionated. I mean, you like salt, you like citrus, and you prefer certain kinds of salt. You have a special olive oil preference. You really have defined tastes, haven't you?
Yeah, but they're not, I don't think they're unattainable. You know, I like Diamond Crystal's kosher salt. They have that in nearly every grocery store. If I can buy it here in Eastern North Carolina, you could buy it anywhere, I think. And so that's the salt that I use for generally everything, unless I'm sprinkling a flaky finishing salt on something just before I eat it. And I have two olive oils, relatively, you know, just inexpensive olive oil for cooking, like if I apply heat to it, and then a nicer olive oil that I enjoy its taste for drizzling on top of things. So I think that's relatively streamlined
compared to
a lot of chefs.
Now, two other questions. One, I want to know who comes to your restaurant, and I imagine since you've been receiving all these awards and getting a lot of ink over everything, that you're probably getting a lot of strangers dragged into this little town.
Yes, we our restaurant's been open almost 11 years, and for the first five of those, you know, we drew from the region, Eastern North Carolina, and some from the Triangle, the Raleigh-Durham area.
Yeah.
But over the past 5 years, we've been getting guests every night from far-flung places, you know, Alaska, Minnesota. The show's incredibly popular in Seattle, so we get a lot of West Coasters. We get a ton of people traveling from the Northeast down to Florida. We're about an hour off of 95, so we get a lot of folks who take advantage of being close to us, and they come to dinner.
Yeah, and you mentioned something, which was my second question. Tell our listeners about your television, your PBS series.
So we have a series called A Chef's Life, and it's a documentary film series that's about people and place and family and tradition told through the lens of food. So it's not a cooking show necessarily. Every episode is about an ingredient, much like my book, and we tell the story of that ingredient through my life.
Now, I'm a tad confused, because somewhere I read you actually have two restaurants.
We do.
Just clarify that for listeners.
Yes, we have Chef and the Farmer, which was our original restaurant, and then the Boiler Room, which is going to be 4 years old this year. And it's just right across the street, and it's an oyster and burger restaurant. It's an homage to the steamed oyster tradition in Eastern North Carolina.
Okay, that like oyster bakes on the beach. That's a big thing, isn't it?
Well, no, actually what we do here, there's lots of oyster bars, and you go in and you order your oysters by the peck or the half peck, and you order them rare, medium, or well, and they get steamed in the shell, and then a shucker comes out and shucks them very quickly and kind of throws them at you, and you eat them with a saltine and drawn butter and cocktail sauce.
Wow.
And it's this very specific regional tradition that I personally love. It's something you do in it's most popular when it's kind of chilly out. And so we opened a place that is in the spirit of those old school joints.
Now, this elbow lick tomato sandwich is an example of your sense of humor with the photograph.
Yeah. But I don't know if you've ever tried, but you really can't lick your elbow.
No, I don't think so. I'm trying right now. I can't.
Yeah.
We're going to mention that you have twins, and 5-year-old girls, right?
A girl and a boy.
And 5-year-old.
Twins.
5 years old, and your daughter is having a ceremony that you have to rush off to attend to, right?
Yes. I'm actually heading out the door right this second. I hadn't been looking at the phone, so.
Well, anyhow, we'll let you go to that because Lord knows that's first, anyhow, in all of our lives, in our mother years. And I just can't tell you how much I'm enjoying your writing and how much I'd really like to get to your restaurant, really.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. Read the oyster chapter, the opening to that, and that'll really explain the oyster bar tradition. And it's, I think it's the funniest story in the book.
Okay.
My dad doesn't think so, but everyone else does.
Well, Vivian, continued success with everything in your life, and hopefully we'll meet sometime.
Well, thank you so much. I hope so. I hope so. Thank you all for taking the time with me today.
And you too, Vivian. Vivian Howard, the book is Deep Run Roots, and you really must get it, listeners.
Certainly an interesting journey, huh?
Yes.
And a fascinating story, and I wish your restaurant was just around the corner.
Oh, I know. I mean,
instead of 400 or 500 miles away, but we'll make a point of getting there, nevertheless, and we'll probably eat at the place across the street while we're there.
That sounds great.
So, in the meantime, I guess it's time for us to take a break, and don't go away, because we'll be right back right after that with other adventures in the South.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Now, our next guest, Terry Thompson Anderson, that's hyphenated. We've interviewed her before. She has a reputation for being an expert in a part of the South that is too big and too bald to ever be overlooked or not heard from. It's called Texas. I mean, that's the name of the state. She's also turning her attention to a day part that's becoming increasingly more important and featured. That is breakfast. So the book is Breakfast in Texas. Let's hear Terry Thompson Anderson. Well, we've interviewed Terry Thompson Anderson before. She is a cookbook author, a big fan and promoter of Texas. And we interviewed you in 2014, and I believe that book, Texas on the Table, won a James Beard Cookbook Award, Terry, huh?
Well, it was a finalist. Unfortunately, Sean Brock from Charleston beat me out, but it was such an honor just to have been nominated. I was totally shocked.
It was a good book. We talked about that. And this current book, of course, I think I started out before saying everything about Texas is big, and your book, Breakfast in Texas, shows that that day part meal is also very big in Texas, breakfast.
Right.
Now, you told me, you and your photographer, Sandy Wilson, how many miles did you travel collecting these recipes?
About 26,000.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a big place, huh? Texas.
Yeah.
It is a big state. And, of course, you know, we did a lot of crisscrossing and a lot of country roads. And thank goodness that actually Sandy is my sister.
Oh.
And, yes, and we have worked together on a number of books. And thankfully, my sister and brother-in-law have a small airplane, so we were able to cover a lot of those miles with their plane.
Oh, well, that's sure. Great.
Now, where do you actually start out from, Terry? Where is your home base?
Well, at the time that we started this book, I was living in Fredericksburg, right in the heart of the country, and Sandy lived in Houston, where she still lives. And in the meantime, I have moved to Rockport, which is a lovely little town on the Texas Gulf Coast.
The Gulf Coast is beautiful.
Now, the hill country, that's the area where they grow a lot of the wines that flourish in Texas these days?
Oh, yes. Yes, the Hill Country is just ripe with wineries, and we have over 300 wineries in Texas now, so it's a very serious business.
Years ago, we were at, where were we, in Dallas?
The mansion on Turtle Creek.
Mansion on Turtle Creek, and Peter challenged the sommelier.
Yeah, it was a joke. It was a long-standing joke that we always tried to drink wine from whatever country we're in. And since we were in Texas, I said, "Mr. Sommelier, your job is to produce a decent white and red wine from Texas." And he was not in the least bit nonplussed, and produced two excellent wines, and showed me that in fact he had an entire Texas wine list up his sleeve if people were really interested.
The mansion has always been a big supporter of the Texas wine industry, uh-huh. And we have some great ones now.
Yeah.
Now do they drink wine for breakfast in Texas? They must, right?
Hey, there's plenty of booze in this bar.
There is. Okay. Well, I just wanted to make sure.
Right.
Well, breakfast is getting to be a very important meal in all categories, all over the place. Suddenly, everybody has discovered breakfast.
Right.
But, yeah, but you have a lot, because you have such a diversity in your population, a lot of different influences. Could you run through some of those?
Certainly. Of course, the biggest ethnic influence on Texas food for a couple hundred years has been the Mexican influence.
Right.
Because, of course, they were the original residents of the state, other than the native Indians. There's also a huge German population, a lot of Czech people. We do have a small number of French people that have settled in various regions over the years. And most recently, Asian and Indian influences. After the fall of Vietnam, many, many, many Vietnamese families on the Texas coast to take up the fishing industry that they knew in Vietnam, and as well as a lot of Thai people. It's become a great melting pot here in Texas.
So, and you've explored all these different influences, and I call it situation. You describe situations that, and then supplied recipes for those situations, and these became your chapters, such as breakfast and brunch libations, crack and egg, pancakes, French toast, waffles, meat lovers, breakfast and brunch dishes, breakfast and brunch from the bounty of the water, which is an interesting thing because I never think of seafood for breakfast, and your chapter is going to change my mind. And then you even are up to date with vegan breakfast brunch menus, which you can also use as sides. That wonderful, glorious section on pastries. Did I leave any out?
No, that's, and then of course in the chapter with the vegan brunches is also a number of great sides, all those wonderful things like hash browns and black-eyed peas that we so enjoy for breakfast in Texas to accompany our other dishes.
Now there's one group of historical Texans, I guess I would describe them as, who don't seem to be in there, and those are the people who had breakfast at the chuck wagon, the cowboys. I mean,
the cowboys. You mentioned the original vaqueros and the campfire cooking, but of course, you know, there's not a great deal of it left in Texas today. We do have a number of large ranches left that do have bunkhouses and feed the cowboys, and those would be like the steak and egg kind of breakfast, and along with a lot of refried beans and on the side of the plate.
Yeah, we interviewed one, didn't we?
Yeah, we interviewed a guy who actually led chuck wagon tours, if you like to think of it that way. So he would take groups of people who were aficionados for that lifestyle and take them on simulated cattle drives.
And he wrote a book.
Yeah, and he wrote a book all about it.
We interviewed.
Including all the recipes.
I think it's called Cowboy Cuisine.
Probably is.
Wow.
He's a character. I mean, he never broke character for 1 minute. And his wife is some sort of super educated professional, too. I can't remember what she is. But he was.
Oh my goodness!
Oh, he was a delight. You should look it up. Look up that cookbook. He's. I mean, I.
What's the name of it?
Cowboy Cuisine.
Okay. Yeah, I need to do that. I'm not. What's his name?
I can't remember. It'll go if you just Google Cowboy Cuisine, or if you go in our archives, and just do find in this page Cowboy, you'll find it. I'm sure.
Okay. Okay.
So,
well, it was an interesting aspect in the in the history of our state.
Sure.
The cattle drives. Very important.
Yeah. Tell us about this famous Texas whiskey milk punch. And I thought that was an old libation, but you indicate it's not all that old, right?
Well, milk punch, of course, is usually in other parts of the country made with cognac or brandy. But in Texas, people really, really like to use whiskey.
Yeah, well, what else is milk punch? I can't sort of picture having it for breakfast, but...
Well, it's a great brunch dish, to pair with a later morning meal. Of course, I don't think you'd find a whole lot of people having it at 7 o'clock in the morning before they dash off to work. But I would hope not anyway, but it makes a great drink for a nice weekend brunch.
Now you have, in the colored pages, you have little informational essays. Like I'm looking at Texas Hill Country Distillery, Legal Moonshine. How many of those do you do in the book?
How many which?
How many of these little sections of information essays?
Well, there's quite a few. I put a section also in the book on hot sauces because the use of hot sauce is very, very big in Texas. And I am fascinated by hot sauces. It's one of my favorite things to do when I visit grocery stores in other cities. I always go to the hot sauce aisle to see if there's any new ones I don't know about because they all have their individual taste. And, most people will look at you like you're crazy because they say they have different tastes. They're not just hot. I said, well, of course not, or they wouldn't be all the different brands because they have different chilies that they use, different methods of producing them. Some are cooked. Some are mainly just a marinated mash like Tabasco and several different varieties, but they all have a specific use. And you will find a lot of chefs in Texas that are absolutely devoted to one particular brand of hot sauce.
And what's your favorite?
My favorite?
Yeah.
It just depends on what I'm going to use it with or dash it on top of because, as I said, the taste really varies. Definitely, if I'm using seafood, I probably would lean toward Tabasco or just plain egg dishes. If I have something that has a little bit of a Mexican flair, I love Cholula, which is actually the Cuervo tequila.
Uh-huh.
Then, of course, there's Texas Pete's, which is made in Texas, but it has its own flavor. And a lot of Texas chefs swear by Crystal hot sauce.
Oh, I don't know that one even.
It's actually produced in New Orleans.
Oh.
It has a very different flavor from Tabasco.
Now, you have a very important chapter on the basics of cooking eggs. I mean, there have been whole books written on just the egg.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm sure you have opinions about the correct way of cooking eggs.
Oh, yeah. Everybody has their method of cooking eggs. And I just basically wanted to cover the how-to, the essential. And then my story on how to scramble eggs is kind of interesting because I actually learned how to scramble eggs from Julia Child.
Oh, yeah. Tell us that story, yeah.
It was fascinating. It was at an early, early, many years ago meeting of the IACP, the International Association of Culinary Professionals, and I think it was maybe like I was a charter member, maybe like our second or third annual, and they just had their 40th. So, and it was when the hotel brunch buffet where it had the little guys standing around with their, you could get your omelet or your egg dish done to order. And I think it was the St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco where we were meeting that year, and they had the little omelet station breakfast. And Julia and her husband, Paul, came into the breakfast room, and we were, as I said, we were a small gathering. I think we had, like, slightly over 100 or something members.
Boy, it's different now.
Oh, yes. We have thousands from all over the world.
Oh, yes.
And Julia walked up to one of the little guys, and a few of us happened to be standing around, and she asked if she might scramble eggs. And, of course, he looked at her and, like, you know, yes, ma'am, you could have anything you want. And then she looked at him and said, well, young man, do you know how to perfectly scramble an egg? And he said, probably not. So she said, would you like to learn? And so we all started, you know, just kind of spreading to space. And she went behind the table and commandeered his little station and asked him for some tepid water and lots of butter. And the egg saw that she was then a little crowd of all of us wanting to know how to perfectly scramble it. She gave up, and it was fascinating. And I actually, even though I had graduated from culinary school, learned so much in that little 10-minute dissertation before she slid those perfectly scrambled eggs onto the plate that Paul was holding for her.
Oh, wow. So I guess that we should mention that you have chefs and cooks in this book and their recipes and advice. You also have outstanding cafes and restaurants. You have a Knock Your Socks Off, Brennan's of Houston's Banana Foster for the dessert. So there's so many things to recommend this book. What is your favorite thing that you accomplished with this book?
I hope just to raise awareness of breakfast and what a joyous occasion it can be. When my daughter was growing up, even though I always worked, and of course when she was in school, but I always insisted that she eat breakfast. So I would get up extra early to fix a nice hearty breakfast for her every day before she went to school. And I was always amazed at the number of her little friends who basically got anything to eat in the morning. And it's so important that we eat in the morning because we have to have food to fuel the brain and get us started. It's much better if you have to do without a meal, do without lunch. but don't do without breakfast. So I hope to, as I said, make people aware that it's not only an important meal, the most important meal of the day, the nutritionists tell us, but that it can also be fun and delicious. And, you know, why eat things that taste bad for breakfast or that are boring? Or, even oatmeal can be an adventure. And you probably noticed I have a pretty large section on oatmeal
you
and
do.
How to make it wonderful. Yes.
Well, so. in my native land, they serve what's called a full English breakfast. You don't have a full Texas breakfast, but you have a pretty good replica.
Well,
right.
Well, Terry, congratulations on this book. And as you say, I think breakfast is getting a lot of attention, and it should, because it's so important. And the variety of these recipes is just, it shows what a melting pot Texas is.
Well, thank you very much. Breakfast is getting attention. It was interesting during the process of writing the book. My editor would often just send me random newspaper links or magazine links and say, boy, you had a great idea here. Look at all the press that breakfast is getting.
Well, it's a beautiful book, and your sister does great photos, so... Anyhow, listeners, it's called Breakfast in Texas, subtitled Recipes for Elegant Brunches, Down-Home Classics, and Local Favorites by Terry Thompson Anderson, that's hyphenated, and photos by her sister, Sandy Wilson. Thank you for talking to us yet again, Terry.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Back on our last segment. Well, we had so much fun with Matt Moore, the interviewee, and I love the title of his book, The South's Best Butts. Isn't that cute?
Yeah. But
he was fun to interview.
Yeah, Matt, he's from Nashville, Tennessee. He does play an instrument.
Yeah, he is musical.
And we can sort of picture him on The Voice, which you're watching right now. And he thinks Blake Shelton can really sing. So if he says so, I guess it must be right. He certainly knows a lot about butts and a lot about barbecue. So you're going to learn something in the next few minutes for sure. And if not, you'll laugh along with us anyway. So do that at the very least. So here's Matt. I think I got the idea that this was going to be a pretty entertaining book when I got to the page that said, barbecue's like butts, everybody has one.
Yeah, opinions are like butts.
Opinions are like butts,
yep.
There you go. And I'm not really quite sure what you meant by that.
You're not sure what I meant by that?
No.
I am. Why is
that
so
joke,
puzzling?
Huh? It was just
a
joke.
It's actually used, typically there's another name, another word used besides butts, but I had to
there we go.
keep it clean for this one.
But they do that kind of thing in Nashville, right?
Oh yeah, everybody's got a butt, right?
Everybody's
in a butt,
and everybody's got a guitar, and who's that guy who's on The Voice that everybody loves so much?
Blake Shelton.
Blake Shelton. Everybody thinks Blake Shelton is the bee's knees. I understand you told us before we came on the air, I'm a much better singer than Blake Shelton.
No, I didn't say that. He's actually, I'll be honest with you. The old Nashville sound isn't as authentic as it used to be, but Blake Shelton can sing, man. He's a great singer.
Yeah, he can.
But I bet you know more about barbecue than he does.
Most likely, yeah.
And we're talking about a book called The South's Best Butts, which is the third book by Matt Moore, who does a little music on the side, but mostly seems to be an expert on barbecue. Does that describe you well?
Oh, I think we could probably come up with about 20 descriptions, but I like what you came up with, so we'll roll with that one.
So what was the goal? What was it? And there are 1,000 barbecue books out there.
Sure.
Most of them have landed in our hallway.
You know, my goal with any book or food writing or recipes to make things approachable for other people to use. I think it's a beautiful book. You know, there's hundreds of photos from location to shots that we took in the studio to just showcase how beautiful this food can be. At the same time, I want this to be a book that people enjoy flipping through, but they also enjoy cooking through it as well. So barbecue can be a pretty intimidating subject, and I felt it important to introduce you to some great folks that are carrying on the grand tradition of barbecue, but also to break it down in ways that people can enjoy these recipes, have over friends of their home, and also enjoy a lot of the fruits of the labor.
Right. So you've got a number of stories going on at the same time, sort of threads that are woven together.
Yeah, I think stories are super important. You know, I like to write kind of in a snapshot. We were on the wide open road, or sometimes hopped in my plane and flew to some of these rural places to meet these people and sample their food, and more importantly, tell their story. And I think that's the fun part. I think this is a bit of a not only just a cookbook and obviously plenty of recipes, but it's a bit of a road trip. And if you don't have the means or can't travel throughout these regions, it's my hope that you can read these little vignettes, kind of a day in the life, sneak peek behind the scenes. And
you've got some great characters in here. Yeah, right? They're real great characters. How did you pick who you're going to cover? There's so many to pick from.
I think a bit of it was serendipitous. I think if you're going to be in the barbecue business, you got to love what you do. You're up before anybody even thinks about waking up. You're cooking food for 12, 16, 20 hours. And then you can have pretty thick skin because everybody, like we say, opinions are like butts. Everybody has one. Well, everybody has an opinion on who makes the best barbecue.
Sure.
So in this sense, I just think there's a lot of good people within the field of cooking barbecue. And I kind of just let recommendations, trusted friends, I'd ask around, and it just happened pretty organically. And I think that's hopefully what you see when you read the book. It's not something that was really staged by any means. A lot of times I'd show up on location and met people and I had no idea what their backstory was.
Really?
It was so fun to uncover that.
Yeah, I like your quote here. There are a bunch of places to get a pork sandwich, and if nobody talks to you, it's just a pork sandwich.
Yeah, that's from Skip Steele, who's probably the most famous gentleman, and he was actually the first pitmaster that I interviewed for the book up in St. Louis. And he is just a salt-of-the-earth kind of guy. I mean, he's the kind of guy that you want to eat barbecue with and drink beers with and hang out later on. And he's got so much knowledge and wisdom, but his backstory is being an old engineer on ships all over the world to just being a personable guy. And he is that person that's walking the line and shaking everybody's hand. He's got a big old personality, and everybody's welcome. And I think that's a big part of his success.
Yeah, now you have pretty well covered the so-called barbecue belt, which is different from the Bible belt.
Also up for debate, right?
Yes, you're right. But people get really heated over this discussion or the right way to make barbecue.
They do, and I felt that it was important that we did recognize the commonly associated barbecue belt and at least went to destination within every state. And that's exactly what we did. So, I think that you'll find some different destinations highlighted. You know, Texas is known for barbecue, but I think most often the spotlight is shown on Austin and Dallas and Houston. We found an incredible place down in San Antonio, Texas, that cooks up a brisket that I would rival against anybody else. You get the recipe for that in the book. But more importantly, being in San Antonio near the military bases, you know, pork butts are not a big thing in Texas barbecue. It's almost sacrilegious. But he cooks an incredible butt because so many of the military men and women want a taste of home, and he had to learn how to do that. And, stories like that are what we encountered throughout our travels. You'll meet a lot of people that you may have heard of if you're familiar with the barbecue world, and probably some of those that you've never heard of.
You know, this is a little bit off the subject, but I kind of like that all these pages you turn to have them in the graphics include what looks like grease smudges on all the... I thought that was cool.
Yeah, I think wax paper and those kind of the field that we wanted to go with. Like I said, I wanted you to be kind of a day in the life in a lot of these places.
I thought you were just leafing through it when you were cooking.
Well, hopefully it's torn and spilled and tattered because that means you're using it.
No, not yet, but it will be, I promise.
Now, you pick the butt, a particular cut, mm-hmm. For a particular reason or a particular set of reasons.
I did. You know, I think we were talking about music earlier, so let's just pretend that we're the band of barbecue. You know, ribs are often like the lead singer of the band. You know, everybody loves ribs, and they're often finicky. Brisket lately is kind of like the lead guitarist that's been sitting over there trying to steal the spotlight. I think behind the scenes you have had the pork butt, you know, call it the drummer, the bass player that's keeping everybody in time, not looking for the spotlight, holding everything together. And I think by focusing on this particular cut, it allowed us to learn all the different brines and smokes and techniques and sauces and methods that each region plays upon. And at the same time, it's not a book just solely on pork butts. I mean, we've got everything from, you know, smoked chicken wings to a Texas-style brisket to a barbecue spaghetti to a pork belly.
Yeah, that one is a stop right there. That one is the one I couldn't swallow.
What's that?
The barbecued spaghetti.
Couldn't follow that one?
I couldn't swallow it.
It's actually a Memphis tradition, right? So, you know, things evolve over time, and you look at Skyline Chili served over spaghetti, a sweeter kind of meat-based sauce that over time is kind of adapted into a barbecue spaghetti. It's actually quite delicious.
So it just kind of floated down the river from Cincinnati, huh?
Oh, well, I don't know about that. It might have been created in Memphis, kind of like Elvis, right?
Well, yeah, I guess so. But, I mean, Cincinnati, I guess, features itself as the capital of chili.
Yeah, and of course, it's a different kind of chili. If you've ever had Cincinnati cinnamon
chili,
and
right?
Nutmeg fragrant chili, and you're used to a Texas chili, you're probably going to be in for shock.
Yes.
It's more like a grandmother's Greek bolognese than anything else.
But, you know, you really go all out here. I mean, you have all these Vietnamese-style barbecues.
Yeah, you know, one of the places we visit in Atlanta, Georgia, is a place called the Heirloom Barbecue Market. And it's run by a husband and wife.
Yeah.
She's from Korea. And so
there's
a lot of influence in those recipes. And to me, you know, I wanted to catch barbecue today, not where it was 50 years ago or where it's going to be in 50 years in the future. I think, you know, diversity is key. And you've got people from all different colors, all different ethnicities that we represent, men and women, that are carrying on this tradition. So I really wanted to capture where we are today.
Well, Korean barbecue is world famous. I mean,
it is.
Yeah.
But I would not call it Korean barbecue. In fact, I would call it true Southern barbecue with a Korean influence.
Okay.
You mean that would be your version of it?
Yeah. I mean, I think that they're staying true to the roots of Southern barbecue. Cody Taylor, who's the pitmaster there, is born and raised in Texas and spent a lot of time in Tennessee, so he really understands that influence. It's his wife who has, you know, created some tweaks to the recipes, and it's not a Korean barbecue per se. It's just she's using ingredients that she's familiar with and just creating a new hybrid form, which is absolutely delicious, by the way.
I bet it is. Yeah.
Interestingly enough, we have two versions of the Korean barbecue sauce in our refrigerator right now. Most people don't have any, but we have two.
Exactly.
And it's really excellent chili.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an excellent sauce if you want to control, you want a little controlled heat in what it is you're cooking.
Sure thing.
You do not only the meat itself, but you also do all the fixins, as you call them. Lots of sausage.
That's right.
Sides. More coarse slaw than I ever saw in the place, probably.
Slaws could be their own subject, but yeah, a Southern barbecue is not complete without all the fixins and sides and desserts, and I wanted to round out the book with a lot of some of my favorite comfort foods and fresh vegetables and everything in between. And one thing I will say, the pork butt is a bit of a commitment. Throughout the book, you see how people approach this cut. Some folks cut it into a 1.5-inch thick steak that only requires it to be smoked for about an hour and a half, and other people are smoking at 200 degrees for 20 hours.
Mm-hmm.
If that's too intimidating for you, you can always source pulled pork from your grocery store or your local restaurant and use that as the base for a lot of these great recipes.
Yeah, but you have you really go far afield here. In addition to the spaghetti, I'm not sure about this barbecue pot pie with cheese grits crust.
Well, darling, you need to come down south and eat a little bit of it because it's another one of my favorite recipes.
Really?
You know? Cheese grit crust, it's just got everything that crust made out of breadcrumbs does not have.
now you have an interesting viewpoint, I think, because a lot of the people we interview about barbecue, like Meathead, for example,
mm-hmm.
Meathead's a real purist.
Sure.
He is.
And you're approachable, I guess. Is it? And
well, I think he's fantastic. I mean, goodness, the amount of science and knowledge that he's brought,
oh,
I qualify him as a real expert in the field. You know, for me, I'm a bit of the everyday guy that, like I said, I invite you to sit right seat in a small Piper Cherokee and come along to some of these places and meet the people. This is more a book about journey and the adventure, but also the people that are carrying on the tradition. And obviously, there was quite a bit of knowledge that these experts share with me that I felt important to share with the reader.
Now, what I was saying is you're not such an incredible purist that you won't allow the fact that you can cook barbecue with charcoal briquettes.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the same time, you know, I've got to be realistic. Am I a purist, and do I appreciate those that cook the old-fashioned way over open pits using only wood like you see in a lot of the Carolinas or what you see Helen Turner do in Brownsville, Tennessee? Absolutely. But for me to sit here and say that some of the places that use the hybrid method of gas and wood, that their barbecue wasn't fantastic, it would just not be truthful. Because I think those that know the skill and business in this sense, they've perfected whatever their method is. And I felt like it was worth showcasing to the readers and also highlighting for folks at home that they can cook great barbecue, whether they dig a pit in the backyard or they get a $100 grill or, you know, a $1,500 green egg. Hopefully they'll use these recipes as a template to create their own styles.
No, I thought that was great, but I was going to go on to a second one to say, but this man is wise as well, because he says make sure your wood, let's suppose you go for wood, make sure that wood is seasoned, make sure it's dry.
Absolutely.
Otherwise you'll get something that doesn't taste very good.
Yeah.
And it will be kind of a shame, and you'll wish you'll have someone who for the rest of their life will wish for Kingsford charcoal when, in fact, that's okay, but real mesquite dried out properly is going to give you a far superior result.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's where people that talk about barbecue and variances and pecan tree grown in Texas are going to taste different than one in Georgia. You know, it just is what it is. That's why I still think the road trip or the journey of barbecue will always exist. Smokers are seasoned differently, and over time, you know, a new smoker is going to taste different than one that's been cooking for 50 years. Same thing with my grandmother's cast iron. It always has a little bit more love than what
yeah.
I have in my own kitchen. So
we have some of that, my grandmother's cast iron.
It's
a lot of something on it. I'm not sure what.
Funny thing, we had the opportunity, I just mentioned this one, Matt, before we go. Did we get the McElhenney barrel chips or the Jim Beam chips first?
I don't remember. Probably Jim Beam's.
Okay, we were at a whiskey tasting, being addressed by Booker No, who was at that point the titular head of the Jim Beam distillery.
Sure.
And we asked him what they did with their old barrels. And he said, I don't know whether he said we chop them up or what, but we discovered that he would do that for us.
He sold them, so
we
paid for
them. Did we pay for those?
We didn't pay for them first, but he does sell them.
Yeah,
he doesn't
gotcha.
Get them to everybody for nothing.
But you have to be careful. You have to be careful with them because there's a fair amount of ignitable material.
Oh, absolutely.
In the chips, but the ones that surprised us were the McElhenney chili sauce chips.
Okay. Well, you know what they always call that in bourbon making, right? The stuff that stays in the barrel is the devil's cut, and that which is released through evaporation is
the angel's share. Okay, got it.
The angel's share, right.
Right.
Yeah, but this is full of all kinds of interesting things, like Texas caviar deviled eggs, the pigskin deviled eggs.
I wanted people, like I said, to be able to entertain from it. I see it as a great tailgating book. I see it as a summer cookout book, but at the same time, you've got a sausage and tasso pecan recipe, which is great on a cold day. It's a regional, you know, year-round type book that I'm really proud of.
I mean, your words rang true when you said about how you spend all that time tending this the meat roasting in the pit, and then everybody scarfs it down in a few minutes. We've had our share of pig roast,
yeah,
where you dig a pit and, you know, you do the pig in there.
Oh,
and
yeah,
it takes forever to dig the pit, and then you have to watch and baby this thing, this pig, all day long, and then they descend on it like vultures.
Well, you know, it's more about the journey. I always enjoy doing whole hog roast, and I have more fun listening to Hank Williams and drinking cold beers with friends than I do actually anything with regards to eating the pig. So those are always a fun day and a celebration for sure.
Well, anyhow, we've enjoyed it.
Well, we'll have an opportunity for our paths to cross.
Yeah, me
If the organizers of the Nashville Food and Wine Festival do the right thing this year and say, yeah, come on down, like they did 2 years ago.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic.
We'll come on down and we'll connect.
I've been able to do that festival, so maybe they'll hear all of us.
Yeah, well, you know, you've been to the Food and Wine Festival, right?
I have, yes.
Yeah, so that whole area is Pat the Pitmaster.
Sure.
And they're doing chickens, and they're doing, what else, goats, and they're doing, I don't know what, I see you have a recipe for Brunswick stew here, they're probably doing a squirrel in there, too.
Another debate, did it come from Georgia or Virginia?
Yeah.
No, how many squirrels do you put in there?
Well, if you're at my house, we typically will add a little venison to that one.
No, we asked somebody who was a barbecue expert. I think it was a lady. I can't remember who it was.
She was very super serious, and she was really appalled that we wanted to know how many squirrels she used in her Brunswick.
No, she found out. She said she had a friend who was on Wall Street, of all things. So she called up this friend and said, "How many squirrels in Brunswick stew?" And the answer came back, 5. How they got to 5, I have no idea. And
that's classic.
The end of the story is not how she found 5 squirrels. It's just what was called for in the recipe.
Well, Matt, it's been a delight talking to you, and I wish you a lot of luck with your documentary of it, and also with the book.
Hey, thank you, guys. It's a pleasure. Next time I'm up in Pittsburgh, we'll have to go get Permanente Brothers together.
Oh, you like Permanente Brothers? They just opened a new one. They're getting very far away from the original Permanente Brothers.
Yeah, I like the old one down on.
Yeah, that's the only one that's really classic.
Yeah, fried egg on top of that too.
Yeah, that's good. Anyhow, hopefully, if you get in touch with us if you come to Pittsburgh, and maybe we'll see you in Nashville.
Okay, thank you guys so much.
Thanks, Matt. Bye bye.
All right, appreciate it.
We said you'd have a good time with Matt, and I'm sure you agree. But in the meantime, we have to say goodbye because it's time for On the Menu to go off the air until a week from now when we'll be here, same time, same place. We hope you are too.
Bye-bye.
In the meantime, bye-bye. Oh, there she goes. Bye-bye. She's the bye-bye lady.